And welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm your host, Tadza Lenovic. Earlier this week, I was joined online by Dr. Puyan Tamimi Arab to discuss his monograph, Amplifying Islam in the European Soundscape, Religious Pluralism and Secularism in the Netherlands. The book was published recently by Bloomsbury Press, and it's an extraordinary addition to current debates about the changing face of Europe. The monograph focuses on the Netherlands, but it has broader implications. I'm sure that anyone interested in the study of economic migration, the current refugee crisis, or nationalism will find it very relevant. The book's emphasis on sound as a frame for analysis will be inspiring for a range of scholars. As someone interested in material culture, for example, I certainly found this perspective productive. In the midst of the gloom and doom that justly accompanies recent debates about the rise of the European far right, Puyan's optimistic take on civic negotiations is refreshing. As you'll hear shortly, Puyan discovered that religious tolerance might actually be on the rise in the Netherlands. Thank you for joining us. I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I did.
Hi, Puyan.
Hi. Hello. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
I'd actually like to begin our conversation with maybe if you can tell us a bit about your background, your academic background, that is, and what brought you to this specific project.
Yeah, so you don't start studying an Islamic call to prayer. So it was actually a long process before I got to this topic. I first studied a few months physics as an undergrad. Then I immediately switched to art history, focusing mainly on European art history, Italian Renaissance. And I did a BA in philosophy, political philosophy. I was very much interested in German and Greek philosophy. And while I was, you know, focusing on these more Europe-centric studies, I was also reading books by Islamic reformists, for example, Tariq Ramadan, as a kind of hobby. And then during the master's, which was in political philosophy at the New School for Social Research, there I also, again, read texts by Muslim reformists as something next to my more broader interest in political philosophy, especially the issue of secularism. And it was not until the PhD actually that that I embarked on a full-scale research on Islam and secularism in the European context.
So there's so many issues I want to ask you about, but I thought that we might begin with some context and definition. So could you maybe start us off with explaining what is the Azan, what is its history and importance to Islam, and then what is a soundscape?
Right. So, well, very important to my research in the Netherlands was especially that the Muslim call to prayer is mandatory only inside the mosque. So it's a practice that goes back to the early days of Islam. Mm-hmm. But of course, the use of loudspeakers is a modern phenomenon. And the dissertation the book that is based on a dissertation. Mm-hmm. Focuses mainly on the public aspect of the Azan, so the use of the loudspeakers, which is not considered mandatory by many Muslims throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So this gives a kind of nice tension because many Muslims, especially Turkish Dutch citizens, would say, well, it's not mandatory if you go back to, let's say, traditional Islamic practice, but we would like to do it anyway, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because it's a public expression of religion.
Right.
And the notion of soundscapes, of course, comes from a famous musicologist, Raymond Murray Schaeffer, who wrote this book on soundscapes in modern times, and he also coined the term soundscape. And he was very critical about the use of loudspeakers, right? So the loudspeakers were something that he associated with you know, modern, even totalitarian or semi-totalitarian regimes. Uh-huh. And he even in this famous book on soundscapes, he even writes that Islam waned when it started to use the loudspeakers. And it's very interesting, I think, because the kind of assumption there is that there is this traditional Islam, maybe a kind of even a romantic vision of Islam that doesn't use loudspeakers. But of course, in the 20th century, all across the world, Muslims have been using loudspeakers.
So, I mean, this call to prayer would ideally be sounded twice a day, right?
Well, ideally, ideally, I think for many more, let's say, traditional Muslim majority countries, we're talking about five times a day, actually, mm-hmm. because, of course, you pray five times a day. But in the Netherlands, the focus is on once or twice a day for those mosques who wish to actually use loudspeakers. They don't, amplify the call to prayer in Amsterdam at night or in the morning. It's nothing. It's not about that. It's usually all these political debates about the call to prayer are about either a single call to prayer once a week on Fridays, mm-hmm. Or maybe one or two call to prayers in the afternoons.
Okay, we'll talk in a second about what this struggle over the call to prayer actually exposes, right. Because I think, you know, for you it works as a lens into current culture. But first, maybe just another context question, and that is, what is the place of religion and public worship in the Netherlands, as well as what is the history of Muslim presence in the country?
Right, so that is that's quite a complex.
Two big questions to start with.
Right, so I think what I try to show in the book is that you can see that in the Netherlands, a country that was once could be described by this using the idea of a Protestant fatherland, right? Mm-hmm. A country where Catholics were not allowed to sing in public. Where even if Catholics would kneel in public and take off their hats, that would be experienced as extremely shocking from such a country. And where also Catholics were not allowed to ring church bells for many centuries after the Reformation. And they could only construct churches after the French Revolution. In the 20th century, there is a very interesting convergence around the idea of religious freedom. And that includes not only for Christians, Catholics, Protestants, but also for Muslims, Sikhs, and others to publicly practice the religion. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Catholic, the notorious prohibition on Catholic processions was officially lifted as late as 1983. Mm-hmm. Although there were, of course, Catholic processions occurring. And this lifting on the ban against Catholic processions coincided with enabling other religions, for example, Islam, to publicly, orally express their religion, Muslims to express their religion.
So before, for example, there were no sounding of bells of churches?
Right. There were, of course, Protestant churches, let's say in the 17th century, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But one of the assumptions about church bells is that they are an unproblematic, you know, essentially normal part of Dutch culture. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is not the case because Catholics could not ring church bells. For example, in Rotterdam, mm-hmm. The great Catholic church in Rotterdam could not ring church bells for more than 200 years. And only in the 19th century did Catholics started doing that again, quite with a vengeance, right? Mm-hmm. So Catholics really constructed many churches in the 19th and 20th centuries until after World War II, the secularization process in the Netherlands, or some call it the de-churching process, really got going. And the difference between Catholics and Protestants became less and less important.
Mm-hmm. And so the landscape, the soundscape also changes, right?
Right. So suddenly, well, your question was also about when did Islam come to the Netherlands?
Right.
Well, of course, we are talking about a former colonial empire, which had Indonesia and Suriname as, places where there were many Muslims, of course, especially in Indonesia. But if we only speak about the, let's say, the mainland, what is now the Netherlands, the first mosque there was constructed only after World War II in The Hague. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a new phenomenon. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, actually, there was a kind of steady process of people who are now called former guest workers from Turkey, Morocco, but also from former colonial settings who constructed mosques at a later stage often also broadcasted calls to prayer. So very often the battle for the building is the first one, right?
So the space, so the struggle over space.
Yeah, these are, you have to imagine, when I went to do research in mosques, many people would tell me, building is not important, it's all about the heart, and you can pray wherever you like, and the whole world is a mosque, and so on. But of course, in reality, what you see is that maybe 50 families are willing to save up money for 20 years to construct a building, right?
Right.
So that shows very directly that material forms of religion and building, but also sounds, are actually very important to practice and to the ideas about one's position in society, regardless of, what people tell you, that in fact it's all unimportant and, you can pray wherever you like.
I'm happy you brought that up, because it's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, this, what the lens of sound actually, to mix metaphors, but enabled you to show, because I think this is it's a perfect example of what you're trying to do, to show that these kind of debates about the call to prayer are actually masking other debates that are happening, right? Like over space.
Exactly.
Is there other things that you feel that that are revealed when you think about sound in this way?
Yeah, first of all, I think what sound did for me in this research was to kind of navigate the boundaries of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I have a background in philosophy, so I'm very much interested in normative concepts like religious tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Netherlands is famous for a tradition of religious tolerance. We say in the Netherlands, we are so tolerant. In the Amsterdam Museum, it even says that tolerance is in the Dutch DNA. This is mm-hmm. a literal quote. So the construction of buildings is something that I first started looking at, and there already you see that there are tensions, sometimes even protests against the construction of such buildings. And this has been studied by several scholars.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound aspect, it really shows you that it's kind of the red line of tolerance, because sound, as a scholar of sound, Isaac Weiner, describes it, it spills over and into, for example, your house, right? Mm-hmm. It does not respect the boundary between private and public in a very sharp manner.
Right.
And for many Dutch people, there is this idea that religion should be a private matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It should, we say, stay within the house. It should stay, behind one's
closed door. Yeah.
Closed door, yeah. But sound doesn't respect it.
Right.
And so when I went to these meetings for the first time to discuss with residents and mosque representatives about the call to prayer, what was really shocking to me was how upset people could get, right? You really have to, this is where anthropology is really comes in. If you want to study religious tolerance, you have to go sit there, and experience also what that feels like, not in the capital, but somewhere, let's say, east of the country, in a small town.
So maybe tell us a bit about your case study, because you did go to one of these towns and you kind of documented a local struggle over the call.
Mm-hmm. So this is, for example, one of the chapters discusses the case of Deventer, which is a town in the east of the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And there a Turkish mosque wanted to call to prayer. And this started, by the way, before the Gezi Park protests in Istanbul,
mm-hmm.
which is important because before those protests, kind of the understanding of Turkish presence was different. Today, of course, with more and more repressive measures by the Turkish government, the call to prayer, how people interpret it, is also changing. So, in 2012, I went to document this series of gatherings about whether the mosque could not broadcast the call to prayer.
Uh-huh.
There were multiple kind of meetings. Some of them, one or two of them, there were around 50 people present.
Uh-huh.
And what I found very interesting is, or maybe counterintuitive if you study the anthropological literature, is the role of the municipality in all of this, which was actually, the municipality really tried hard, I think, to reach some kind of compromise and also to enable, actually, the call to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the aldermen, or we call them wethouder, upholders of the law, one of the aldermen of the town, who is part of the conservative liberal party, he went through quite a long process to help the mosque make this wish come true. While at the same time, on the national level, the minister of the same political party might publicly state that, such calls to prayer should be banned.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows that the local issue is very complex. And that if you only study, let's say, discourse, right? If you only focus on media discourse, you get a warped understanding of how the state actually regulates sounds in such a small town.
Well, I mean, I think you even argue a bit more forcibly to say that's actually there is a new kind of Dutch pluralism that is evident in the legislation rather than in the discourse.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken, right?
Exactly. So people debate, right?
Mm-hmm.
They might not like the label of tolerance, right? So some people told me I am not tolerant. I don't want to be tolerant, right? But if you study there, what they actually do, they are quite tolerant, right? They accept the results. For example, the result that the mosque is allowed to call to prayer every day.
Mm-hmm.
They don't protest further against it. Most people, of course, not everybody. And all of this is because of, let's say, what I call the gorilla in the room, which is the Dutch constitution, And the Dutch constitution gives the mosques the power to negotiate, right? So they're not asking to be tolerated in the sense of permission, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we have different conceptions of a big concept, tolerance. And one of these traditional Dutch conceptions was permission, right? So something is actually not allowed, but we permit it, right? So, for mm-hmm. example, Catholics are not allowed to construct churches. However, if they have these clandestine churches, we'll accept it. Mm-hmm. That's not the case when we're talking about Islamic calls to prayer. What we see is that the law, which is new, it was drafted in the 1980s, that this law allows new manifestations of religions to occur in the Netherlands. And this is the effects of legal changes are also slow, right? So maybe this law is from the 1980s, but its effects are still playing out. And you see that it's not just Islam. So, for example, in another city, Almere, which is a kind of working class town that was constructed after World War II, in Almere, there's a mosque, a Hindu temple, a Vietnamese Buddhist temple, all next to each other, right? Mm. And if the mosque, let's say, wants to call to prayer, the fact that the law allows it to do so gives it a kind of leverage in these negotiations, right? Because technically speaking, the mosque does not require any permission. It can just announce its wish to call to prayer and then do so. Mm-hmm. So there's no permit or anything like that.
So why do the mosques' leaders still initiate these negotiations if it's something that could have just been done?
Yeah, so this is the second part, which is that shows that bottom-up pressures against these practices are effective in minimizing the sound. Mm-hmm. So... And mosque representatives, they don't want to kind of, you know, engage in a kind of neighborhood war, right? Mm-hmm. They want to have friendly relations with their neighbors. So what happens very often also based on the past experiences and also the advice of people working at the municipality is to engage in a kind of negotiating, mm-hmm. which is called in the Netherlands, it's called polderen. And the Dutch so-called polder model is a very much a kind of decentralized consensus-based model of governance where, you know, things are not solved by court cases. So I think that was very interesting in Isaac Weiner's book about the same issue in the United States, that he focused very much on court cases. Mm-hmm. But in the Netherlands, there has never been a court case about Islamic calls to prayer in the last 40 years, right? Because people basically know that the law allows this practice, so they negotiate on mm-hmm. the volume and the duration and so on. Mm-hmm.
So actually, it's also a negotiation about the character of the place, right? It's
exactly.
About who belongs in this city or townscape, who can make calls for negotiations and belong.
Right. It's what I found very interesting is that some people would tell me that, you know, qua religion, we don't need to do this. But we would like to because it's a political issue. Mm-hmm. And it's the call to prayer can, for many people, create a sense of belonging. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is quite a complex phenomenon because there are, let's say, nostalgic reasons. Maybe mm-hmm. the elders like to listen to the call to prayer because that's what they listened to when they were young boys. Mm-hmm. But there are also other reasons. For example, a wish to publicly announce presence in mm-hmm. the contemporary mm-hmm. Netherlands. And of course, the call to prayer in the Turkish case has a whole history of its own. So, especially for Turkish people in the Netherlands, it seems to be something that is very important. You know, the call to prayer is mentioned in the Turkish national anthem. Mm-hmm. And it is definitely part of Turkish nationalist sentiments. It produces kind of Turkish nationalist feelings. At the same time, it's also important for feeling at home as a Dutch citizen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These two, for ordinary people, these two things don't contradict.
So I want to ask you about contemporary politics and the way that, you know, extreme right politicians use exactly these sounds to talk to their voters and to signal what you call, you know, you quote in some places as kind of a pollution,
right,
of the air with this sound. So can you tell us, you know, like there was just the very recent election, and how did these things play out in the public discourse?
Right. So, of course, very important here is the figure of Mr. Geert Wilders,
mm-hmm.
Who in the recent elections, although he did not win, he was the second biggest party in the Netherlands. And he has kind of changed his stance throughout the year. So he has, of course, always protested against the call to prayer in let's say, the last 10 years. But he has also called for banning the construction of new mosques and even banning the Quran, which is, of course, it's just a ludicrous, political mm-hmm. statement. Mm-hmm. And it has a very, I think these kind of statements do have an impact on how people experience Islamic presence. So it's not just about pollution in the sense of mere noise pollution.
Mm-hmm.
It's pollution in the sense of Islamic noise pollution, right? But right. What I found very interesting is that in these kind of debates on the ground level, people might not actually use the idea of Islamic noise pollution, right? Some people will just say, no, it's just noise. I just don't want to be bothered by noise, because they know that if you protest against religion, you will be seen as a bigot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you just say you protest against mere noise, then that's kind of better. But I think it becomes very clear, this kind of discourse, Geert Wilders' discourse, becomes very clear if I read to you what he wrote in what he spoke of in the Dutch parliament a few years ago mm-hmm. about pollution. And this is what he said. He said, "A better environment begins with oneself. Many Dutchmen are irritated by the pollution of public space by Islam. In some places, our Dutch streets increasingly resemble the streetscapes of Mecca and Tehran. Headscarves, hate beards, burqas, men in weird white dresses. Let us do something about this. Let us reconquer our streets. Let us make sure that the Netherlands will finally again look like the Netherlands." Right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in such a kind of nationalist conception of the Netherlands, Islamic presence stands out. It's seen as something that is, you know, in the words of Mary Douglas, it's out of place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But something being out of place is not a pure physical objective question, right? It's you can see this in research on noise pollution of airplanes, for example, where the decrease of the volume of noise pollution does not mean that the protests against noise pollution also decrease. Right? It's actually possible that noise lessens, but still the protests increase. That shows very much that the experience of noise pollution is socially constructed.
Well, and also what is seen as noise rather than, let's say, music, or, as you say, an evocation of a home or belonging, right?
Yes, exactly. So the problem is where to draw the line of the right to belong for Muslim citizens on the one hand, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, for non-Muslims who also have a right to be left alone, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. And this is not something merely of, let's say, white non-Muslim citizens versus brown Muslim citizens. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. There are also Turkish Dutch citizens who don't like to hear the call to prayer, right? It's not that black and white, mm-hmm. But it's the thing is that this new Dutch pluralism that you indeed mentioned, it allows for a variety of public manifestations of religion, mm-hmm. in the Netherlands, and this is something that is quite new if you look at it historically. Mm-hmm. If you not look at the past, let's say, 20 or 30 years, but mm-hmm. the past 200 years or even more, then you see that we now experience something that may be called a kind of unprecedented religious diversity.
Mm-hmm. Which is surprising, because what we're usually kind of hear about is the tension, right? The tension with exactly like with groups like the represented by far right, and the discussion about Muslim communities is in Europe is usually kind of constructed as a discourse of tension and crisis.
Well, I think the idea basically is that tension and crisis excludes the notion of emancipation. Mm-hmm. But what you see with the Catholics in the 19th century, the Netherlands also, is that their emancipation, which means their right to construct churches, basically, that their emancipation coincided with tension. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That you see that when Muslims in the Netherlands increasingly constructed mosques, it did not lead to a decrease of tension. So emancipation is not, you know, something nice that everybody agrees on and holds each other hands, right? Emancipation is hard. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing that this process is happening. So I'm actually, you know, on the one hand, there is definitely a very scary xenophobic you know, nationalist understanding of the nation that is becoming more and more popular in Europe in the past, let's say, 20 years. And it's frightening. On the other hand, for example, in a country like the Netherlands, but also Germany, also Sweden, also Great Britain, Muslims can now practice their religion in a more public manner, mm-hmm. than in the mm-hmm. past. Mm-hmm. So I think that we really should be worried about nationalism, but also at the same time realize that tension can be productive.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that, like, along this kind of conclusion that is maybe counter to what, you know, we're usually told by the media, that surprised you when you were conducting this research?
By the media?
Or not necessarily by the media, but something that you maybe came into the field thinking a certain thing and then was surprised to find that actually, you know, on the ground it's a bit different.
Yes, I think for me, coming from philosophy, it is humbling to see how tolerance is actually created on the ground level. You know, philosophers like to debate about concepts. Mm-hmm. So the idea very often seems to be that you need to read many books about tolerance and you need to engage in discussions and then maybe become more tolerant. But that's actually not what happens. What you see is that there are public deliberations. And people learn in a kind of hard way. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily agree on concepts, but they learn to tolerate each other in practice. And as they are deliberating, they are also at the same time disciplined by the state, which says that, you know, for example, Muslims have the right to call to prayer. So deliberation, discipline, tolerance, these are all created in practice. And there's not this conceptual debate that precedes practice. I think it's very important to understand that in reality, tolerance is created by doing it.
Yeah, and by mixing rather than segregating.
Yes.
To conclude, can I ask you something maybe a little bit more personal? Because you do write very movingly about, you know, growing up in a mixed and migrant neighborhoods and in a society that doesn't always look very favorably about, you know, Dutch Muslim youths. But you also write with a lot of pride about your mother, a cultural anthropologist herself. Can you maybe think what this mix has done for your, for this project? Like, how did it prepare you to think about these issues?
Right. So I think that the fact that I was born in Iran has stimulated me to take really serious the issue of religious tolerance and also the state governance of religion. Mm-hmm. And while I agree with many colleagues, anthropologists, that we should be very critical of notions like religious freedom or secularism, I also think that it's very important to study in practice what happens and to do that in a way that matters to Muslims in the Netherlands, in a country like the Netherlands. So my departure point was, what is required for the emancipation of Muslims in the Netherlands, right? Mm-hmm. And the notion of equal rights, regardless of where you come from or what your religion is, has been really it is central to improving the idea of religious freedom in a country like the Netherlands, right? Religious freedom is something that's constantly being contested and negotiated, and there is, I think, very much space for improving it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the coming from a country like Iran and growing up in a mixed migrant community, on the one hand, it helped me because on the one hand, I could be kind of, I could identify with many of these people. I could share feelings of intimacy with them. But at the same time, it also allowed me, because I am, of course, slightly different, right? They have a different background. They are from countries like Suriname, Turkey, and Morocco. It also allowed me to preserve a critical distance, I hope.
Okay, I really want to thank you for this conversation and for your fantastic book. I loved it.
Thank you very much.